thank you for listening to the Just Completed program. If you'd like to offer feedback on any of our programming, please email us at info@wpfw.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Peace, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together, we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard?
Understand, we've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Day of the week is it? What day is it? It's Tuesday, March 19th, 2024. Time for that show that's not for the politically faint of heart, Voices with Vision. And this episode is no different. We come bearing gifts of a hard-hitting nature. If it's too much for you, then you might be one of those faint of heart. I'm Nefer Freeman in the virtual studio with Brother Craig, and for the next hour, we'll be your co-host. What's good, Brother Craig? What's good?
The African Revolution is good. Good morning, Nefa, and good morning to all our listeners and podcast subscribers. Today we speak with two brilliant, radical young sisters, Jamila Alexander and Sister Sheena, who warn us about the Maryland House of Delegates House Bill 814, legislation that expands the carceral state to lock up more of our children at younger ages.
Yes, and some of you may have heard that the country Niger is making moves to kick out AFRICOM and the U.S. altogether. For that, in the second half, we'll get the insights of the editor of Pan-African Newswire, Abayomi Ezekwe. Mumia Abu-Jamal will start us off with the good news of a win for now former death row inmate Daniel Gwynn. And for all our political prisoners like Mumia, all our freedom fighters languishing behind prison walls, what's the call?
Free them all.
Gwynn gets a win. Daniel Gwynn, a death row prisoner for almost 30 years, is now leaving death row and prison itself after his case was finally dismissed, after the case fell apart. For almost 30 years, Gwynn was subject to decades of solitary confinement under threat of imminent death and soul-aching loneliness. Gwynn's conviction stems from both a false confession and apparently tampering with witnesses by police and the prosecutor. He was charged and convicted of murder, arson, and aggravated assault in the death of Marcia Smith of the 4500 block of Chestnut Street in West Philadelphia in November 1994. The woman died from smoke inhalation, and several others were injured after jumping out of a three-story window. Gwen was charged with setting a fire. Why was the confession suspect? Because Gwen, then in his 20s, was a serious drug fiend. His so-called confession was quite divergent from the facts at issue. How did he survive almost 30 years on death row with his sanity intact? Art. Specifically, he learned how to paint, and he made stunning works of art. When I was on death row at SCI Green, the prison aired shots of artworks on its closed circuit TV channel. I remember seeing a memorable painting of a jazz pianist deep into his music. The keyboard undulated like a wave, seemingly dancing to the music. That work of beauty was painted by Daniel Gwen. Gwen, now 54 years old, is now really free. With love, not fear, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
This is Nepha in the virtual studio with Brother Craig. The Maryland House of Delegates has advanced Bill 814, legislation that revises consequences for children charged with crimes. While this new state legislation is portrayed as reforms for juvenile justice, it's in fact an expansion of the carceral state to include young children. The Black Lives for Peace, Baltimore Citywide Alliance, and the Ujima People's Progress Party of Maryland issued a strong statement denouncing the legislation as an unjust juvenile justice bill. Our guest today to speak with us about this, our Sister Sheena, a Prince George's County, Maryland resident and member of the Ujima People's Progress Party. She prominently expresses an unwavering commitment to political education, emphasizing its importance in the ongoing struggle for Black working class to seize and sustain political power. Quote, "We must organize for Black liberation, not compromise our way to a more palatable form of oppression." Also, Jamila Alexander, a Baltimore native and organizer. She's a member of BAP Baltimore and the Haiti Americas team of the Black Lives for Peace, and a member of the African People's Revolutionary Party. Sister Sheena, Comrade Jamila, welcome to Voices with Vision.
Thank you, Nafa.
Thank you for having us.
Mm-hmm. How about we start by giving listeners a primer on the key provisions in the legislation and what makes it unjust? Sister Sheena, you want to kick us off?
So briefly, the overview, or the synopsis as they called it, some of these key provisions specifically deal with how to approach juvenile offenders, and altering those provisions relates to taking children into custody, expanding the provisions relating to the entry onto certain school and property grounds, and education and sex offender restraints. Again, this being juvenile justice, juveniles would assemble at many of these key places, not because they're offenders, but because they're juveniles.
Yeah, and this bill has been pushed by specifically Baltimore City State's Attorney and Prince George's County's State's Attorney. So they have been working in collusion together. Very similar to what's been going on with DC with the crime bill down there. There has been a planned and executed attack on the youth in this particular area, particularly our African youth in Baltimore City and in D.C. and the surrounding communities.
I guess I'll direct this question to Jamila first, at least. These crime bills that we're seeing in D.C. and that we see in Baltimore and, of course, across the country as well, that are expanding police powers, that are targeting African youth, that are increasing punitive measures, and all of that is going on. But let's talk about this allocation of resources from the state and how this reveals the character of this capitalist system and its government agents. I know Black Alliance for Peace has pointed out that the state spends $414,929 a year to incarcerate and lock up a child, and the police are offering $20,000 signing bonuses to boost police recruitment, and yet they're crying about a lack of resources for teachers, hiring more teachers and investing in education. What would you say about what this says about the crime bill, about the system?
Thank you for that question, Craig. So I think this really explains where we are domestically as colonized and captured people. When we think about Orisami Burton's definition of the captive maternal and how we are here as Africans in the U.S., but our ancestors were brought here and captured, and we have been under domestic colonization from our captors from the very beginning, and we still are. So when these crime bills come out, for me and for my comrades, it's a chance to remind the community about where we're at structurally in the U.S. Colonial empire. When we have to explain to the masses and our neighbors about the fact that in Maryland, they're trying to charge and hold accountable. This is the language that's being used against these children, holding accountable 10 and 12 year olds. When we think about in DC, how they're lowering the felony amount of stolen goods from $1,000 to $500. And we are looking at this targeted attack of even in DC, how expensive DC as a city and the surrounding area has gotten in the past 10 years compared to how it has been before. They're specifically pricing out the people that lived in the area for a very long period of time. And then we think about the $3,300 million cop city they're trying to build on Coppin State University with the FBI facility they're trying to move in Greenbelt. All these things are happening all at the same time, and they're extremely planned, and that they show us that our role in the society is to be in a certain spot, and the society that we live in will use the armed agents of the state to control us and to keep us structurally in that location and keep us controlled. When we think about the fact that this area has a lot of Black mayors, Black governor, Black state's attorney, Black senators, et cetera. But it's the same thing that's happening in areas that we could say that are deemed as Republican states and areas. It's bigger than just a red or blue thing. This is a targeted attack on the citizens that have helped provide the American empire with what it has been able to receive. Yeah, I'm sure Sheena can also expand on a couple of other things, but that's what I think of immediately off the top of my head when I see the direct impact of these bills on our communities.
Yes. In January, when Westmore unveiled this plan for juvenile justice, if you want to call it reform, you know, it received not only just the support of Democratic legislators, as Jamila mentioned, this is a collaborative effort to the point that even the language was refined by some of the GOP members of the Maryland legislature, even though Westmore is a Democrat. Mass incarceration and the project to control movement and any type of progress that African people can make is a joint effort. They agree, they work across the aisle, they will be tough on crime together. What we as a captive people in a settler colonial relationship with all these institutions are witnessing is their commitment to working together to keep us captured. We have to come together more effectively to denounce what it is they're doing. We have to organize against their collective effort to keep us in a trap position. When I saw Ivan Bates, the Baltimore City state's attorney, hanging out with Aisha Braveboy, the Prince George's County state's attorney, drumming up public support for their tough on crime, you know, provisions and their development and their encouragement to make sure that these kids aren't quote unquote participating in organized crime with the car thefts, as the news collaborates with leading with these stories about how juveniles are stealing cars, about how they're taking them to chop shops, completely void of the context that these are often African, poor, working class, under, you know, developed communities filled with people who have nothing. How do you get from point A to point B when your motions are restricted? How can you afford to travel on Metro? Where are you trying to afford to travel to? What is causing you to get into these situations? All of this legislation ignores that and leaps to a correction, or in terms of what they're saying, a swift removal from society, which is not about teaching people how the society is designed to keep them in this powerlessness. Instead, it wants to remove them from it and teach them a lesson, hold them accountable for the failures of the system surrounding them by taking them out and putting them into institutions so that they can't participate in the activities that have been criminalized or deemed criminal by the people participating in them. They're not considered people who are doing things for the thrill, but it's also not connected to their need to survive either. So if you're stealing, if you're caught participating in the illicit economy, they want to take you out of it instead of taking out the conditions that create the need to participate in an illicit economy. And many children are in that stage because they have working class parents who cannot be there to stop them from going out on their own. If your child needs to eat, and they say, I could grab something out of the store, I don't have money to go get it because I'm not hireable at 10, 11, 12, so maybe I shoplift. Now, they're not shoplifting $1,000 worth of groceries or even $500 worth of groceries, but if you steal something to survive, nothing is criminal about you being in a position to not survive in the first place, but your response to your need to survive is criminalized, it's penalized. You're told that you're not doing it the right way. And we have to understand that as Africans, that's our children, that's our community, that's our people that are being associated with these new laws. I have a child who is very much close to the demographic of children that this is targeting. In a few years, this can't afford to get my attention later. It has to have my attention now, so that by the time my son is 10, I am not colluding and I'm not accepting his prejudgment. And I hope that that's what people take away from this statement and take away from what is going on currently.
And we're talking about children, you know, as young as 10 years old. So, you know, that's something for people to think about. This bill is addressing children, young children, our kids.
Mm-hmm. And like we said, I mean, you know, these are conditions that are born from the state, the system, neoliberalism and all that. And then the criminals who are doing all kind of things and raking in hundreds of thousands of dollars, and some of them even responsible for genocide around the world, they're not even considered criminals. But, you know, one of the things that both of you touched on, and I want to ask you to go deeper into it, and the statement that you put out goes a little deeper, and I think it mentions it, is the fact that these moves being, you know, made around the country, criminalization, crime bills, legislation like this, are primarily implemented and even introduced by Black officials, mayors, council people, state legislators and governors, what we generally refer to as the Black misleadership class a lot of times. Why do you think this is? What does it say about where we are right now? Why you think it is?
and the implications. How does that affect the job we have to do as revolutionaries, as Pan-African revolutionaries?
As the system currently stands, there are a number of positions within these institutions that are waiting for misleadership. You can become a prosecutor, you can become a cop, you can become a decorated veteran, and then you can pivot into a long political career, having served your country, having served your people, having served empire in that capacity. What that then allows you to do is be a first Black, a decorated Black. But in times of unpopular political eras, like when people are struggling with mass unemployment, poverty, illness, you always can default to crime. You can always stoke the fears of people being threatened or endangered by somebody poor taking something from them. So you can be tough on crime, but you can't be tough on changing material conditions for people. And that is something that is true of any politician. For the years that Larry Hogan was in charge of Maryland, he was also tough on crime. He's a Republican. Wes Moore says he's nobody's Republican, but he's turning around and being tough on crime just like Larry Hogan was, to the point that he's collaborating with the GOP just in his, what, this is his second year in office officially, but a decorated military veteran. He ran on a record that said this was going to be a part of his strategy. The Prince George's County Executive is a former prosecutor. The current state's attorney has an eye on being the next county executive. These people are climbing the ladder, and they know that they can't leave crime and punishment out of that professional role, because the next thing their opponent has to do is say, well, they were soft on crime, and that's going to lose them votes.
Yeah. So before I start, I wanted to share that I misquoted. I said something about the captive maternal, and that was for Orisami Burton. That actually is Joy Jane's term, but the term I was meaning to quote actually is the idea of Queen Mother Moore, which Orisami opens his book Tip of the Spear about, which is the idea of recapturing and being in relationship to being in a domestic colony. Mm-hmm. But to just expand a little bit on some things that Sheena was sharing, particularly we're seeing these things pop up so much and so targeted with a Black or African politicians, is because we are at the place in our society
we like to say Negro here when we talk about them.
Oh, sorry.
Go ahead. No, I'm just playing. Go ahead.
The African Americans, you know, they want to assimilate. So they're in communication with the petty bourgeoisie. They look up to the institutions that this empire pushes out. And they want to assimilate into the culture. So if that means that they have to betray the people that they are also share family with, they don't care. As long as they're able to create generational quote unquote wealth, and we know, because Dr. Ball shares with us that is a joke as well, there is no generational wealth within a capitalist American society. So I'll yield there.
Yeah, it's wealth and status and power. I mean, a lot of people, right, in this day and age with I don't know what you would call celebrityism, and people also wanting, you know, to be seen and known. And, you know, like I think Sheena mentioned it already, the accolades and be rewarded and seen. So a lot of people are chasing that. And as the conditions of capitalism deteriorate, there are issues, fundamental issues that can't. You both said it very well. I guess I don't even need it. I guess it would be called mansplaining. So let me just let it go. It's like they, you know, they're carrying the water for master, you know, to master's bidding.
That's what we have, these politicians. They're in bed with the police and they're concerned with their careers as opposed to addressing the root causes of crime, primarily being poverty, and or even being accountable to the people, because, of course, the parties they are a part of are election clubs that are not organized by the people and that don't have the people's interest at heart. They're serving corporate and capitalist interests. So they take these positions of being, you know, tough on crime. That's good for their career. That's good optics. And that, you know, keeps them in line with, you know, their fellow collaborators. But that being the case, what is it that needs to happen to address crime? Or what would you, what does Black Alliance for Peace, the Ajima People's Party, put forward as being more effective ways for us, the community, and the people, and even, if possible, the state to address crime and poverty?
And if you don't mind, if I can add on to Craig's question, because you both, I think you both read Paca's paper too about what's happening in D.C., the D.C. crime bill thing. So if you're in your answer to Craig, if you can sort of see if there's a compare contrast you can do with what Paca offers and says, even if you got some issues with it, you can state them. We all comrades here, and it's all about struggle. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the first thing that I think of and the thing that I'm always going to say is we have to understand where we're at right now, as where the masses are, not us as individuals or us in our collectives, but us in the collective masses of people that we are around. The number one thing that we should be focusing on is political education. BAP promotes that, PACA promotes that, UJIMA promotes that, and the All African People's Revolutionary Party promotes that. The masses don't know where they're at in society. They think that the U.S. society has a middle class. They think that, you know, you can work your entire life and be able to benefit from small moments. They don't understand really anything that's going on here in the U.S. or in the surrounding world, which does is shown through the interactions of people in the U.S. and how they interact with other global and geopolitical issues around the world. So I'll say political education is like number one, talking with people through where they're at, what's going on around their community and how that relates to what's going on in Haiti, in Palestine, in the Sahel, in the Philippines, and just starting there, showing those connections. We're talking about gangs in Haiti, and they've always been talking about gangs in DC and gangs in Baltimore. It's the same criminalization of Black bodies. So getting people to connect on that level, and that's what we've been really, really working hard on doing with our town halls. And PACA, I know y'all have y'all lovely Asada Shakur study groups every Wednesday or every other Wednesday. But the people are learning, the masses are learning. There's been a large uptake in people that want to join organizations. This time they're joining organizations and they have no choice, but they have to learn. It's not just the fun going out in the streets and being seen. You have to be behind the scenes and you have to educate yourself. So people are getting it, but we need to spread that more and be more calculated about that so we can get it into all the communities that need it.
Yeah, and having read PACA's statement, we have very similar problems with the police state policing and not being able to control or even participate in developing those policies and affecting the outcome. We're inflicted, but we're not affecting change. So as we often discuss, the core issue being power, we have to organize. UJIMA is not a corporate party. We do not have a political fan club. We want to organize people so that they're aware that the solution to their problems cannot come from a corporate backed entity. You know, the people who punish the person who steals food have no solution for ending your hunger. They're not going to give you an inch to make progress. It must be seized. People must seize power, but that cannot be done within these institutions. That cannot be done by appealing to these institutions. It can't be done on the heels of a Muriel Bowser saying she wants to build a new jail, seeing the George Floyd uprisings, and then saying, okay, the new jail is probably not the thing right now, so we're going to paint Black Lives Matter on the streets. You know, because these projects, like with the $330 million Cop City proposed on Cop and State, they didn't propose to put that in Dundalk. They didn't propose to put that somewhere where it's a white concentrated area. They're not proposing to bring the FBI to Prince George's County for just any old reason. We have to collectively organize and build power so that we can say this does not serve working African people's interest, and we have to win ourselves back from these institutions that cause us the most harm.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much to the both of you. People, make sure you check out the statement that informs people deeper about what our guests were telling us about. It's on the Black Alliance for Peace website, theblackallianceforpeace.com. It's on the homepage of that, and it's called BAP Baltimore and Ujima People's Progress Party Denounce Maryland's Unjust Juvenile Justice Bill. We've been speaking with Sister Sheena, Prince George's County, Maryland resident and member of the Ujima People's Progress Party, and also Jamila Alexander, a Baltimore native and organizer and a member of BAP Baltimore and the Haiti Americas team of the Black Alliance for Peace, and also the AAPRP. Thank you both for being on Voice with Vision.
Thank you for having me. Thank you so much for all you do.
You're invited to the timely book event with Jake Johnston about his new book, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti. Tuesday, March 19th at 6 p.m. How did a nation founded on liberation, a people that successfully revolted against their colonizers and enslavers, come to such a precipice, to a state of near collapse? Hear from Jake Johnston of the Center for Economic and Policy Research on how long-standing U.S. and European capitalist goals ensnared and re-enslaved Haiti under the guise of helping it. Jake will be joined by former member of Congress Andy Levine and Dr. Nathalie Fedre-Pierre, assistant professor of African diaspora history at Howard University. That's Tuesday, March 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Bus Boys and Poets, 450 K Street, Northwest D.C. Get more information and RSVP. Go online to bit.ly/aidstatebooktalk. That's bit.ly/aidstatebooktalk. WPFW is your station for jazz and justice, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
You're listening to Voices with Vision, the show that's not for the politically faint of heart, on your jazz and justice station. WPFW, building a better world one broadcast at a time.
Okay, we're back in the virtual studio, Brother Craig and I. We're delighted to have back with us Brother Abayomi Ezekwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire. There's a couple, dare I say, inspiring things going on in the continent of Africa. It's not a dare, but, you know, we like to be inspired by what's happening and what's happening in Africa. And what's inspiring about them is they're decidedly anti-imperialist things. You know, one might be a little bit more anti-imperialist than others, so maybe people may not have known. You may have heard the news, and this was a couple weeks ago, or like last month. No, it was last month. The Zimbabwe government expelled some USAID, U.S. Agency for International Development workers, USAID, they call it, operatives. They were actually, we're going to get into it. They were actually some people commissioned from this group. And then also, and they had a good reason for doing it, but you know how the United States acts. They just think they're entitled to be all over the place. And then another thing that's even more inspiring and actually more decidedly anti-imperialist is the government of Niger, one of the countries that are in the Alliance of Sahel States, along with Burkina Faso and Mali, has announced... This is put your seatbelt on now, y'all. They announced that they're going to expel AFRICOM. Now this is Niger. So to unpack all of that with us, we invited comrade brother Abayomi Ezekwe back to Voice with Vision. Welcome back, brother.
It's good to be back.
And especially under such like now we know this kind of stuff doesn't come without its challenges. We know that imperialism doesn't take too kindly to be. Being unwelcome places. Now, what are your first? Let's deal with one. Which one should we deal with first? Let's do the Zimbabwe one first, since that was an earlier story and probably has less implications than this other one. So your take on the Zimbabwe situation, what do you think people really need to understand about what transpired?
We have to put it in some type of historical and political context. We know over two decades, there's been draconian sanctions against the Republic of Zimbabwe, largely because of its land reform program, which was initiated in 2000. Now, since that time period, there's been numerous efforts to try to overthrow the ZANU-PF government. You had the Movement for Democratic Change, which fractured and fell apart. Then they came up with another coalition with a new leader. I think it was the Citizens for Change, something to that effect. Now they've splintered, fractured, and disintegrated. Then we heard that individual officials in Zimbabwe were being sanctioned again by the Biden administration, including the president, the vice president, and others over alleged human rights violations. Well, who is a worse violator of human rights than the people in Washington, D.C.? So, yes, I think this is all connected to the expulsion of these U.S. aid operatives who came into the country without permission, according to the Sunday Mail, Zimbabwe Sunday Mail from yesterday. So who knows, they could be intelligence operatives, you know, from the Central Intelligence Agency. They have had collaborations with USAID in the past, and I'm sure it's continuing in that regard now. They're probably trying to organize another, you know, anti-ZANU-PF coalition to challenge the government. The sanctions have not been able to, you know, bring down the government, even though, you know, it's a challenge. They've faced a lot of challenges over the last, more than since 2000. Directly as a result of the sanctions. So that still hasn't brought them down yet. So they're still trying to figure out a way of overthrowing the government in Zimbabwe. And even in neighboring South Africa right now, we can see clearly the U.S. Is trying to undermine the ANC once again. The elections are coming up in about 2 months, and they are over the issue of Zionism, over the issue of allegedly selling weapons to Russia. You know, these are outrageous allegations that are being put forward by the Biden administration. Mm-hmm. We don't hear anything. I haven't heard anything from the Congressional Black Caucus, as if they don't exist, other than being cheerleaders for the Biden administration. Other than Cori Bush, she has taken a strong position on Palestine along with Rashida Tlaib. But the majority of the CBC have gone along with the genocide that's taking place in Palestine. South Africa has filed a lawsuit. They've raised this as a top diplomatic initiative on their part. You know, so I don't see how the U.S. can be looked at favorably by anybody who's conscious in the United States, in the African community, that is not looking with anger and disgust at what the Biden administration is doing in Africa, in Palestine, in Yemen, all over the world.
I'll just add on to that. Even domestically, all these crime bills and juvenile just on our populations here, right here in the United States.
Police still killing people. They couldn't pass the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. They couldn't pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. They have not passed the bill to codify within law the reproductive rights for women. You know, they haven't really fulfilled any of their obligations from 2020. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in November.
We went
into another, yet another Trump administration, which will be even more calamitous than what we saw between 2016 and 2020.
Yeah, we got some interesting days ahead.
Yes.
But one thing that stood out to me about this news coming out of Zimbabwe about these agents, the report is saying that they were on a clandestine, you know, sort of political mission. They were meeting with anti-government organizations and forces and individuals, and even some people who are against the government that are even a part of the government, and that their whole purpose was to gather information about a better ways to create regime change, that is, take over the political part of the country and seize control of power. Now, this is a country where, in spite of sanctions and all types of other interference, where, you know, there has been some type of relationship. And it's kind of like exposes the fact that, you know, all these relationships that African countries and other countries have with the United States only exist to serve the interests of the United States and U.S. imperialism, and that's it.
Exactly. And that's the same situation in the Sahel, where in Niger, for example, they have two U.S. Drone stations that are operated by the U.S. Africa Command, and that's a uranium-rich country, and they have been put under sanctions. Now, the sanctions have been lifted by ECOWAS and by Nigeria. The sanctions that Nigeria had imposed, which was causing a lot of problems because they are neighbors, and they've lifted those. That's what they announced in recent weeks. So now they're trying a different method. So they send a high-level U.S. State Department delegation to Niger, apparently to try to, shore up their relationships. And the reports that came out was that it's not working and they need to pack up and leave. So this is going to be a major blow to the Biden foreign policy once again. So they need to be very vigilant so there won't be a plot to try to remove the CNSP leadership in Niger, and also in Mali and Burkina Faso, which have formed a military and a political alliance known as the Alliance of Sahel States. So these are very interesting developments that are taking place.
And we have to assume, too, that, you know, the plot is underway. And yes. So, you know, we're hoping that, of course, it won't be successful. But there's meetings going on right now trying to figure out, you know, which way do they want to go.
You know, this is all very interesting because, like what you laid out, Brother Bami, in terms of the timing of this, ECOWAS just retracted to dealing with this, rolling back its sanctions, Nigeria doing the same thing, and then the move for Niger to expel Africa, or at least call for it. I don't know how easy that will be to get all of them out of there. But it's going to be hard for these other forces that had really the regional body, ECOWAS, and Nigeria in particular, that leadership there, to serve the comprador role they were doing in the beginning of the takeover, military takeover. Now how are they going to turn around now and say, well, no, you need to let Africa? It's not something they would even want to say, I suppose. So it's going to be very interesting. And then in the U.S., probably, I don't know what they're going to say to that. They were they're outspoken around the Zimbabwe stuff because it's a different situation, and they call it inappropriate and all that. But for a military to be expelled, for them that to be called for, it's not a good look for you to say, nah, we're not leaving. You know, we're going to keep our military, like that strong arm, especially after the French was kicked out. And one of the things that the government officials were saying in Niger, they actually explicitly said the very existence of U.S. military, including AFRICOM, on their soil is a violation of their sovereignty.
Correct. And 60 years ago, in the book Africa Must Unite, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah said essentially the same thing, that, you know, there should be no U.S. imperialist military bases in Africa. So, you know, it's taken a long time for these developments to carry on. But then you look at it and you figure, well, if they're failing and they failed in Afghanistan, they're losing the war in Ukraine. Even the Pope Francis, head of the Vatican, which is a government, said they should negotiate with Russia. The Ukrainians should negotiate with Russia, even if they have to wave a white flag. And it would be, you know, even more disastrous for them to suffer outright military defeat, which will happen, you know, if they don't shift their position. So if people in Africa are looking at this, and I know they are, because the opposition to the sanctions against Niger was so strong, even within Nigeria itself, even in the ruling party, the APC, mm-hmm. they could not get agreement on sending a military force into a neighboring country. And you have people in the unions, there were all types of people who spoke out against it. So this is the only thing that put it on hold. And now people are realizing that, you know, the United States and France does not have a solution for mm-hmm. security issues, economic issues at all. So I think this is a very, very positive thing that's taking place. But as you said, you know, they could easily strike out in an effort to overthrow those governments. And these are military regimes. You know, they're not even political parties or civilian coalition mm-hmm. governments. They're military regimes. And they're making it clear that they do not feel that the United States involvement in their countries is really helping in terms of security, and it's definitely not helping on an economic and social level.
Mm-hmm. Well, the alliance, though, in other words, if they attack one, they have to be ready to, you know, to call. It's going to mean a tackle on all of them as far as that alliance is concerned.
Yes, look how many people are dying in Gaza, for example. I mean, 31,000, that's the official figure, not to mention those that are still trapped under the rubble. And Biden won't even call for a ceasefire, you know. So if people are looking at this and they're saying, you know, this is a very dangerous situation. And still, you got 10 different resistance brigades that are fighting the Israeli Defense Forces in Gaza for the last more than 5 months. And they have not been able to crush them. So they're putting out statements every day. They're putting out videos every day about, you know, about their attacks on the Israeli Defense Forces. So the U.S., you know, is being challenged on an international level.
And then, like Nefa was referring to as well, in the case of Niger, even this and what you were talking about, it's a military takeover of the government. But these many of these military people involved were trained by the United States. And they're saying that these bases and this relationship with the United States is something that is a violation of their sovereignty, that it was imposed upon them. And they're making references to the United States being arrogant, demanding, or trying to control who they talk to, who they have relationships with regard to probably Russia or maybe even later China and other people. So it's like even these people who have this relationship with the United States or have had it are saying, you know, enough, and are insulted. It kind of reminds me of a little bit of Noriega, you know, who used to be, or even Saddam Hussein, in a way, you know, these people had relationships with the United States military and intelligence services and that type of thing, and played a role in advancing U.S. and Western imperialism. And then at some point, I guess the nationalism and the pride has kicked in now. And now these military leaders are rebelling against their masters and their controllers and saying, hey, you can't insult us. You can't tell us what to do. And you can't be here exploiting our resources. And not only that, but they're saying, too, that in this agreement, the United States is not obligated to help them in their fight against these terrorist groups and these other militants, that it's sort of up to the United States' whim whether or not to get involved.
Yeah. And the question is, you know, these same Takfiri Islamist type groups, you know, have in the past been trained, financed and unleashed by the United States.
That's right.
Against countries in which they don't like, or they have designs to have deeper penetration and control over their resources. We saw that in Libya, you know, some of the same people who they were saying were terrorists. Yeah, they were, all of a sudden they became freedom fighters, according to the U.S. So, yeah. So who knows? They have been reporting. I know in Mali, they've been reporting that the security situation has improved since France left. So we'll have to see what happens in Niger as well.
Mm. Now, I don't know if I would put these new emerging young military people who just joined the military in the same light of as a Noriega or a Saddam Hussein, who are leaders who had, you know, been in power for a while and like met or had their own relationships, direct relationships with imperialism. These are basically young cats that get their training in it, you know, and so and they weren't the ones that invited AFRICOM in. AFRICOM has been there for, you know, when they got there, they were probably really young. It was like 2008.
And so, yeah, we're talking about 16 years now.
Mm-hmm. So they're probably really young. And a lot of them right now, they're not just, this is where I would see also draw a distinction, is like you hear people like Ibrahim Traoré in Burkina Faso invoking the legacy of Thomas Sankara and thinking about that, who was also a military person who turned revolutionary. These are like, I wouldn't call Saddam Hussein and Manuel Noriega revolutionaries, but these folk, these young people seem like they're trying to plot a course toward some, you know, a series like a Pan-Africanism and definitely a self-determination for the people. Something more social, definitely, at least Burkina Faso for sure.
Yeah, it's quite interesting what's been happening over the last year, particularly with the change of power in Niger on July 26th, which is an interesting date in terms of revolutionary history. that they had. They took over on the same day as the, you know, the Moncada Barracks attempt in 1953, 70 years before. Very interesting coincidence. So I think that this should should warn the Biden administration that they cannot continue in the same fashion, but doesn't seem they're alert. They don't seem to have a cohesive policy towards Africa or West Asia, and definitely towards the Russian Federation, China. It's just highly inconsistent. It's imperialist in its orientation. There's no question about that. But they're really trying to find their way in terms of how to, you know, maintain a U.S. imperialist hegemony around the world.
And they just seem to be, and we, I guess this is it, they just seem to be kind of oblivious about the fact that the unipolar domination that they're used to, it's, that those days are gone. You know, they just, they're in denial about that.
Yeah, you look at the BRICS summit, for example, they're talking about de-dollarization. They've set up their own new development bank. You have the G77 plus China that represents like 80% of the world's population. So, you know, the U.S. is becoming more and more isolated, and I don't think the military prowess of the United States is going to be enough to maintain control of these geopolitical regions and also to maintain economic and social stability here in this country, because it has an impact on how the United States is governed vis-a-vis its role in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. You were actually leading to where I was thinking about going, which is to talk about the impact, because as I always say, these elections are coming up here in the United States. Everyone always tells us to focus domestically and not be interested in what's going on in Palestine or what's going on in Africa, et cetera. The, what do you think the impact is for people in the United States, the everyday common people in the United States, that that the United States government and military presence would be diminished in Africa?
Well, that's a talking point that you just outlined. I see it on social media a lot. You don't want to get Trump back in office again, yet people in Palestine are being slaughtered, you know, every day, you know. So how can you trade off? It's like the play that James Baldwin wrote years ago, The Price of the Ticket. You know, what is the price of the ticket to succeed in the U.S. capitalist system? That means you have to sell out your own people, other oppressed people around the world. That's too high of a price for anyone to pay just for access to the ruling interests here in this country. So I don't think that's going to fly, though. We'll see, because a lot of people are saying, and even, you know, like the AME Church, the AME Zion Church, in addition to them, there was 1,000 African-American clergymen that wrote an open letter to Biden calling for a ceasefire in Palestine. And
that's right.
The AME Church and the AME Z, they represent about 4.9 million people in the United States. They can't ignore that. If those people are not motivated to go out to the polls in November, there's no way the Biden
will win. Yeah, they'll lose.
Because you got the young people now that have, a lot of them are turned against the Democratic administration. There's also, you got a huge Arab American, Muslim American population, Latin American people, African people. So if he can't mobilize those folks, he's going to be in serious trouble. And we'll be stuck, you know, with another 4 years of Donald Trump.
Right. Well, you know, well, thank you for that. Well, we say who, no matter who wins the elections, the people lose. But we lose at least the election. It doesn't mean we lose the war against this being waged against the people and humanity. And what we have to do is make sure people understand that, you know, our salvation rests in our own hands as organizers, particularly the revolutionaries, organizing alternatives that the people can see to these this duopoly and this capitalist imperialist system. But thank you so much, brother, for being on. Appreciate your analysis. And so we're speaking with Abaimi Ezekwe, editor of Pan-African Newswire, about all the interrelated issues related to Zimbabwe deporting the USAID workers and also Niger calling for an end, an expelling of the U.S. Africa Command from its soil. Thank you so much for being on Voice with Vision.
Thank you for the invitation, as usual.
That brings us to a conclusion. Thank you for listening.
Hey, I'll see you 6 o'clock this evening at the 5th and K Street Bus Boys and Poets for the book talk, Aid State, Elite Panic, Disaster Capitalism, and the Battle to Control Haiti with Jake Johnston.
Remember to tune in to Voices with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
You can follow me, Netfa, on X, what used to be known as Twitter, Netfa Free. That's N-E-T-F-A, free. And don't forget, you can listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on Google Podcasts or iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision, WPFW. Keep it locked right here for Crossroads with Roach Brown and Nkechi Taifa. Make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people, or...
Fall back. It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. We are L-I-B-R-B-G. We live F-R-E or D-I-E. We lace music with code, just something to bring us closer. Kick true. The young black youth like we supposed to. No swine in our Rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench with young 50 cents and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We score the soundtrack to this movement. Y'all just rap, brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot with Sebley's boy in the back, Miss Rogers boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back, San Kofa right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black. It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people.
Come on.
F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom.
Celebrating 20 years, the New African Film Festival, presented by AFI and Africa World Now Project, brings the vibrancy of African filmmaking from all corners of the continent and across the diaspora to the DMV at the AFI Silver Theater and Cultural Center in downtown Silver Spring from March 15 to the 28th. The festival features 26 films from 16 countries, including 3 years premieres and discussions with filmmakers. Explore the diversity of new filmmaking from Africa at the 2024 New African Film Festival. Tickets and full schedule at AFI.com/silver. That's AFI.com/silver. Or call 301-495-6700. 301-495-6700. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Rev Yearwood, and I am so excited to announce our new climate show, Think 100% Climate Friday. This show will keep you up to date on everything climate justice related in a rapidly changing world. We will discuss breaking news and updates on environmental issues, the climate crisis, COVID-19, and politics. This show will make tangible how the climate crisis is already impacting our lives and what you can do about it. So tune in every Friday at 9 o'clock a.m. right here on WPFW 89.3, your jazz and justice station.
Diverse City Fund is a grassroots grant source for change makers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. Apply online now, no later than Friday, March 29th, by going to the website www.diversecityfund.org. You can send email to info@diversecityfund.org. Upcoming info session dates and past recordings are online to answer all your questions. See www.diversecityfund.org or call 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130.
Diverse City Fund ofrece subvenciones para agentes de cambio de color en la capital de la nación. Financiamos el trabajo de justicia racial y social por y para líderes de color en D.C. Solicite una subvención en línea hoy al más tardar el viernes 29 de marzo visitando el sitio web www.diversecityfund.org. Fechas y horarios y grabaciones de las sesiones informativas pasadas están en nuestra página web. Para preguntas, visiten www.